There's upset week on the show. Today we're going to focus on some of the biggest upsets in sports that really changed, you know, a certain sport or a league or different things like that. And today we are focusing on the NFL and Super Bowl III, of course, the Colts and the Jets. And Bob Lederer, he wrote the book Beyond Broadway Joe, the Super Bowl team that changed football, did a deep dive on the Jets, who, of course, were from the AFL, and they defeated the Baltimore Colts that year 16-7. And really, that was the first time the trademark Super Bowl term was used, in fact, in 68, but January of 1969, as Bob joins us. And Bob, when you look back at how, I know that, you know, he had Broadway Joe and he had the famous claim that, hey, they were going to win and everything was great like that, but just, it really changed the whole concept of football with AFL defeating the NFL.
First of all, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it. And hi to both of the Jasons and hi to Edmonton. And thank you for your sponsor. The game changed of the National Football League and pro football. Somebody asked me a couple of weeks ago, was this game the most important game in NFL history? And this was not the most important game in pro football history. I believe that was the Giants and the Baltimore Colts 10, 11 years before. But this game changed the National Football League in a way that no game before or after ever has. And I'll be real specific. The whole idea of Monday Night Football finally clicked because here in the States, NBC had a contract with the American Football League. CBS had a contract with the National Football League, and ABC became desperate to get into the pro football business. And so the NFL, which had been trying to get a Monday Night Football, you know, extravaganza going for at least 5 or 6 years, finally got somebody to bite on it. And, you know, we've had it ever since. And I don't think it's as important today as it was back then, but it has really been a fixture and something that changed. The other thing that really happened is the Friday afternoon before Super Bowl III, Pete Rozelle, the commissioner of the NFL, had held a annual press conference, which they still do today with the commissioner. And he said that the idea generally at that point was that the NFL was going to absorb the AFL teams. And that meant the Jets were going to go into the New York Giants division, and the Oakland Raiders were going to go into the 49ers division, and the Houston Oilers were going to go in the Dallas Cowboys division, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing wrong with that. But today we have an American Football Conference, which was really put into effect after Super Bowl III, and it is distinct from the National Football Conference. And even though there's a lot of games being played between the two, but the AFL, after the Jets won that game, the owners decided we want to stick together. We want to maintain the structure of the American Football League, even if we're now part of the NFL. So that was a big part of it. But there was another thing that happened, and I can't say this with absolute certainty, but in doing the book that I did, several of the Jets told me that they had heard whispers during the 2 weeks before Super Bowl III that if the Jets got wiped out by Baltimore the way Green Bay had done it to Kansas City 2 years before and Oakland the year after that, that a couple of the AFL teams might not have been absorbed into the NFL. And far and away the worst team in the American Football League at that point was the Boston Patriots. So imagine if the Boston Patriots had ceased to exist. Now, I think down the road, even if that had happened, the NFL would have put another team in Boston. It's too big a market to ignore. But who knows if Tom Brady would have played his pro career somewhere other than in New England.
When you look at this game, the point spread before the game, I believe, was like 17.5 points or something like that. Was there a real feeling outside of maybe the dressing room of the Jets that they could actually pull this off?
There were a couple of writers I talked to who had actually picked the Jets, but they did it very quietly. One of them was Dave Anderson of the New York Times, who told me that It was forbidden by the New York Times sports department to actually make a prediction about the game. But he told me that he had actually told people far and wide the Jets were going to win the game. I have to tell you, I was 16 years old when the Jets won that Super Bowl, and I was as big a fan as they could have had. And Jason, I had absolutely no belief after all the media hype for 2 weeks about what Baltimore was going to do to my team, that they had a chance to win the game. Now, I've talked to professional players, and you know, Jason Strudwick, you were a professional hockey player, so you can't ever go into a game thinking you're going to lose.
Right.
But the confidence level of the Jet players, the veteran Jet players, about playing that game, I was shocked by how much belief they had they were going to win. And they pointed out to me, and I have it in my book, exactly why they believed what they believed. Now, when you combine that with something else that I came to really understand, and that is the Colts were enormously overconfident. They had already, in some cases, spent their Super Bowl winnings. So they had no doubt they were going to win the game. And when the Jets didn't basically get bowled over in the early minutes of the game, because the Colts were trying to kill Namath because of his guarantee. And when that didn't happen, the Colts started to get angrier and angrier, from what the Jet players told me, and they really took themselves out of their own game.
Bob Lederer joins us. We're talking about one of the great upsets in sports history, the Super Bowl III, of course, the Jets going on to down the Baltimore Colts. And, you know, it's interesting, you talk about great coaches. Well, Weeb Eubank was the head coach of the Jets, and he had won two NFL championships with the Baltimore Colts in 1958 and 1959. Now, Grant, I know he hadn't coached them since 62, and so a lot of the players were different, but how was that angle? And it was Don Shula, young Don Shula, as the head coach of the Colts at that time. How was the coaching matchup portrayed?
Back then it was portrayed basically factually, which was that Don Shula happened to be one of Weeb Eubank's favorite players when he was coaching the Colts. And he had actually, I think, had some ideas and plans that after he would leave the Colts, and he didn't leave on his own terms, they said goodbye to him, that he hoped that a guy like Shula was going to get a chance to coach Baltimore, which indeed he did. Unfortunately, Weeb had to lose his job in order to do that. But there's another thing about Weeb that's really rather amazing. He also won championships, not as the head coach, but as an assistant coach with the Cleveland Browns in the old American Football Conference. I should say the All-American Football Conference. Now, they played as a competitor to the NFL from like 1945 to 1949. And the Cleveland Browns won the championship in that league every single year. Paul Brown was the head coach, but Weeb coached on that team as well. So he actually was part of a championship team in three different leagues. So I think that's really something quite amazing. In addition, I discovered that Weeb Eubank really could coach almost any position on the field, although most of the time he gets credit for being a great quarterback coach because he developed Johnny Unitas in Baltimore and Joe Namath in New York. But he was a great kicking coach. He made the Jets kicker Jim Turner into an all-pro, and he actually had coached the Cleveland Browns defensive line. And so he could really – and he was a great offensive line coach. He taught some of the top Jet offensive linemen exactly – you know, how to block and that sort of thing in the most professional way, of course. So he's quite a talent in coaching, and you don't hear his name in the same vein as Lombardi and Paul Brown and Tom Landry and certainly Bill Belichick.
It's interesting. You kind of read the preamble before the game happened. There was so much talk about the Colts defense, but in the end, it was maybe the other defense that would put on the show. How could there have been so much of a misunderstanding about what the Jets could do on that side of the ball?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do, Jason, with the fact that the NFL had just completely overwhelmed the two AFL teams in the first two Super Bowls. And so, you know, the thought generally was, well, the AFL will catch up in about 10 years. The AFL was seen as having too many young players. And ironically, in Super Bowl III, it was the youth of the Jets that really helped them win the game, because the Colts were an older team, particularly on defense. And the Jets' offensive line, basically from right to left, had 4 or 5 years experience, and they were playing against a Colts team defensively. Many of the players there, or many of the key players, were 11, 12, 13, 14-year veterans. And, you know, they had seen better days. So in retrospect, that was a big part, you know, of what happened. The Colts, you know, in one sense, shot themselves in the foot. There were 4 interceptions by the Jets, and there was a fumble recovery as well. But, you know, I've been told by some of the Jets, one of them who became, Billy Joe, became one of the greatest coaches in college football history. And he said, you know, luck is the residue of being prepared to take advantage of it. And when the other team throws the ball in your direction, you better catch the darn thing. And the Jets did that day.
It's upset week on the show. We are talking about some of the greatest upsets in sports, and today we are focused on Super Bowl III, the Jets upsetting the Colts, becoming the first team from the AFL to defeat an NFL team. And Bob Lederer wrote a book about that team, Beyond Broadway Joe, the Super Bowl team that changed football. And Bob, thanks for sticking with us another segment. And I want to get to Joe Namath, because during the Super Bowl lead-up, Namath had talked about Morrell, who is the quarterback for the Colts, and said, hey, there's 5 quarterbacks in the AFL who are better. And then he named them himself, his backup, Bay Parelli, John Hadle of the Chargers, Bob Greasy of the Dolphins, and LaMonica. And he also said, if you put Bay Parelli with Baltimore, Baltimore might be better right now, because Babe throws a better ball. Like, Joe was not one to shy away from giving his opinion.
No, he wasn't. And I don't think that what he said there was all that controversial, except for Parilli. Parilli was 38 years old. He was well past his prime. Earl Morrell was a career backup in the National Football League. I remember watching him with Detroit in the early 60s. And I remembered him with the New York Giants earlier in that very preseason. And when Johnny Unitas got hurt in preseason, the Colts were desperate for, you know, a professional quarterback, and they made a deal with the New York Giants. But Morrell wouldn't even have started for the Giants that year. Nonetheless, he had a career year. He put up great numbers, and he was voted the NFL's most valuable player. But Namath was right, and in fact, I could probably name 3 other American Football League quarterbacks that were better than Earl Morrell. But he'd had a great year, and, you know, privately, a bunch of the Colts players were hoping that, you know, the bubble wasn't going to burst that day, because Morrell had had a terrific year, and the bubble did burst that day.
We've got to talk about Joe Namath and just the legend. You know, leading up to this, you know, we know the swagger and how he loved to talk and all that. But, you know, on the field, how much of an impact did he have on his team winning? Because I know he didn't throw one. I don't think he threw one touchdown in the air, did he?
Well, no, he didn't. But, you know, that's a little bit misleading, Jason, because his job that day was not to be a gunslinger, which was his normal role. His job was to keep the Colts defense on the field and to basically eat away at them, you know, play by play. The Colts had dominated defensively every team they played that year, but the Jets were particularly adept at one thing on offense, and that is picking up blitzes. And blitzes were a huge part of Baltimore's defense. They only got to Namath twice that day. The offensive line, John Schmidt at center, Randy Rasmussen at one guard, and Talamini at the other, and Winston Hill at left tackle, who's going into the Hall of Fame the next time there's a Pro Football Hall of Fame ceremony. And Dave Herman, who moved over from right guard to play right tackle, just protected Namath like nobody's business. Namath only got sacked, I believe, 9 times during the regular season that year. So he was in a cocoon. And it was very hard to get to him. And to give you even a stronger example of it, the year before, Namath had lost his running game. Matt Snell, the fullback, got hurt. Emerson Boozer, the halfback, got hurt. And he was left really with a bunch of guys who they would just hand the ball off to, you know, once every 3 or 4 downs just to try to keep the defense honest. But they couldn't, you know, really, you know, amass any kind of a running game. And Namath ended up throwing for 4,000 yards because all the Jets could do on offense was throw the ball. And Namath was magnificent at doing that. People have asked me, would Joe have even been in the Hall of Fame if he didn't win Super Bowl III? And I have no doubt the answer is no. He would not have been, except for that one game that really made him into an international superstar.
That's really interesting, Bob, especially because it's not like that game had great, but it's just it kind of shows for some people that winning, you know, really, really matters. And that was, you know, it was a different time, of course, way back when. And, you know, now it, with more teams, I think you don't have to have a title to make it to the Hall of Fame. But you're saying Joe was like Broadway Joe. He just seemed built for the spotlight in New York, even though he necessarily wasn't the greatest gifted quarterback.
He was among the most gifted quarterbacks in football history. He had a tremendous arm. He had a great quick release. He backpedaled and got rid of the ball faster than anybody in the NFL. In fact, maybe, you know, as fast as anybody in the history of the league. But he was groomed by the Jets owner, Sonny Werblin, to be not only a great football player, but to become a celebrity. Mm-hmm. And just as an example, Namath had enormous charisma. And Werblin would arrange through his entertainment ties for Joe to take out starlets virtually every night in New York. And Werblin would call the local newspapers and say, Joe's going to be with, you know, Raquel Welch tonight at such and such a place. And the next night he was going to go watch Barbra Streisand and Funny Girl. And then he was going to take her out, you know, that evening. So it was very important. It was very important for the Jets, who were battling for the attention of football fans against a very, very good New York Giant team in the early to mid 60s, you know, to get publicity. And if the publicity basically was, who was Joe Namath out with last night? Well, Sonny Werblin was, you know, very happy just to accept that. He wanted a great football team, but he knew he had to really, he had to create his own Babe Ruth, is the way he described it.
Did it work? Like, well, did the Jets become that popular?
Well, it did, because the Jets, the first year that the new ownership led by Sonny Werblin bought the team, which is in 63, they had to play in what was called the dilapidated Polo Grounds, which is where the New York baseball Giants had played and left before they went to San Francisco. The very next year, Shea Stadium opened up where the Jets and the Mets were playing. And the New York Jets went from like 3,000 season ticket holders to 39,000 season ticket holders the first year they were at Shea Stadium. And I was a kid at the time, and I know how hard it was to get a ticket to see the Jets play. And the other thing that Namath did, Namath was the first professional football player to attract women to the game. He was such a sex symbol. And he was, again, portrayed that way, that the Jets had a lot of ticket holders who were female.
Bob, that never created any distractions for Joe? Like, I mean, it's sure, it sounds like it's a good gig for a, you know, 27-year-old guy, but I just wonder how that affected his on-field performance and the I guess the dressing room.
Jason, you sound like a professional athlete because that's exactly what the problem was before that Super Bowl season. He was out every night with so many different people that there was quite a bit of dissension on the Jets team. And my book is basically about the other guys on the team. I call them the 44 guys not named Namath. And my book is the first and only book that's ever been written that talks to those other guys and basically focuses on them. And a handful of them were not hesitant to tell me how much they really disliked the fact that there were two sets of rules for the Jets. There was one for the team and there was one for Namath. And Sonny Werblin didn't believe in holding Namath up and punishing him, fining him for anything, because he said to Sweeb Eubank, you know, this guy is a superstar. And I don't just mean as a player, but as a personality, as, you know, as a guy that the Jets needed. And so we don't want to punish him for anything. Let him do what he has to do. But he would show up late. One time, particularly the year before the Super Bowl season, he showed up 10 minutes before a home game. And the Jets had their second string quarterbacks warming up. And Namath showed up And the other thing that's interesting about Joe, he did an interview with Playboy magazine about 6 months after the Super Bowl game. And in it, he admitted that he had two rituals the night before a game. One was a blonde and the other was two glasses of Johnny Walker Red. And he showed up for a game, the Super Bowl season and the regular season, and he had not gotten tipsy or drunk the night before. And he got intercepted 5 times that day by the Buffalo Bills in a game the Jets should have won handily. The Bills were horrible. And Dave Herman, the offensive guard on the team, told Namath if he ever showed up to a game again not having been drunk the night before, that Herman was going to put some alcohol right down his throat right then and there in the locker room.
Bob, your book, you mentioned you talked to the guys that hadn't been talked about. And so for Jets fans, they must have loved this book. I would hope that regardless of their age, they would be interested. Okay, here's the team. Yeah, I knew about Joe Namath, but maybe I didn't know this guy or that guy. What was your reaction from fans who weren't Jets fans, but just were NFL fans? Because I'm one of those who's curious. I love learning about players that maybe I didn't know. So to me, this book's fascinating. But how was it received by non-Jets fans?
I think the reviews, if you look at them on Amazon, are really good. I talked to a lot of Jet fans about the book. And I have to admit to you one thing, and that is that the younger fans don't seem to get it as easily as you don't have to be I'm 68 years old, okay? You don't have to be 60, 65 or older to appreciate what that team was, because the way I describe the 68 Super Bowl Jets, I grew up in New York in the 60s, and I was a New York Mets fan, but I knew all about the Yankees as well. And because I knew about the Yankees, I knew about the 27 Yankees, what they called Murderer's Row with Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. And I mean, Babe Ruth out-homered the entire American League that year. That's considered the greatest team in New York Yankee history and maybe in baseball history. I look at the 68 Jets in the context of the Jet franchise as the Jets version of the 27 Yankees. And I say that because the week after the Super Bowl, the American Football League All-Star game was played, and the Jets sent 11 players to the game, Namath and 10 other guys who had terrific, just enormously great years that year. And so the Jets really were loaded that year on offense and on defense, on the lines and in the talent, the positions, running back and wide receiver and everything else. So just a tremendous team. And real Jet fans is what I tell people, really should find out everything they can about this team, because really it is something to be marveled at. And Weave Eubank gets, most of the credit, because he not only drafted the guys, but he then molded them into professional players.
Talking about Beyond Broadway Joe, the Super Bowl that team changed, the team that changed football, the author Bob Lederer. Bob, there's a lot of professional sports teams around New York, and I'm wondering, if you're ranking championships by New York-based teams, and we'll just stick with the big four sports, where does this title rank amongst its four big sport peers?
Well, you can look at it two ways. For your look this week at upsets, I would probably have to admit that the Mets winning the World Series that very year is the greatest upset that any New York team had. And I was a Met fan as well. But the greatest teams, hey, I got to be honest. I mean, the Yankees have had so many great teams that, it's just – as a Met fan, it's tough to be a Met fan. but the New York Giants had a number of terrific, football championship teams.
Oh, yeah.
During those years. And, of course, you had the Brooklyn Dodgers, who didn't win, only won one World Series, but they were continually getting into the World Series. And so they had, great teams. And the New York Giants and the Willie Mays era, they went to the World Series twice. The Rangers, Well, we know about 1940 and we know about 1994.
Yes.
And, you know, and I remember the 94 team, obviously. And the Islanders, you know, had that period where they were really the dynasty of the National Hockey League. So, you know, New York has been lucky in a lot of ways to have a lot of great teams. And what seems to happen when you look at it is that when one team wins, it kind of rubs off on some of the others. One of the Jets players, Paul Rochester, who died last week, told me that the Jets had a sauna inside Shea Stadium for their own use. They had built it and they used it. And as the season was being played after the Jets had won the Super Bowl, Tom Seaver, Jerry Kuzman, Nolan Ryan, maybe one other pitcher from the Mets came in and said, hey, can we use the sauna too? And Rochester told me that they all got all in there together in the sauna. And one of the Jet players said to the Met players, you know, if we can win the Super Bowl, you can win the World Series. And that's exactly what happened that year.
Wow. It's crazy. Crazy yeah. stuff. Bob, yeah. Thanks so much for this. I know people can get the book if they want to check it out. It's very in-depth. It's awesome.
If you don't mind, let me just say the game can be found on YouTube, the entire Super Bowl III. In fact, it was televised here in the States last week. But NBC has put the entire game on.
Wow.
You can see it from start to finish, including with commercials. And what I'd recommend to people is before or after you watch the game, get the book. It'll give you a lot of fresh insights that were not even known at the time of that broadcast.
I love it. The book is called Beyond Broadway Joe, the Super Bowl Team That Changed Football by Bob Lederer. Bob, great stuff. We really appreciate your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate it as well.